Hello, and welcome to Real Talk, where curiosity chases truth, every Tuesday at noon on KVSH 101.9 FM and on voiceofashon.org at your convenience. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, and so happy to have you here. Today, I am privileged to be talking with Vashon's own Lori Hennessy. While we can call her our own here on Vashon, Lori's personal and professional impact has reverberated way beyond our island. She has 30 years of professional experience in nonprofits, politics, grassroots engagement, public relations, and government. She started her career as a radio reporter, then worked on the Capitol Hill as a press secretary, before spending the rest of her career promoting and raising money for nonprofits. She has served on several Vashon Island boards and has been active in community theater and music over the years, often appearing on stage with her now grown children. She's a former parenting columnist for The Beachcomber and still writes for the paper occasionally. She is currently the CEO of the League of Education Voters, a statewide educational advocacy organization, and also serves on the board of the state chapter of the National Women's Political Caucus. But today, we are talking to her because she is a speaker for Humanities Washington, talking about her own experiences dealing with sexual harassment scandal long ago that involved then-U.S. Senator Bob Packwood from Oregon, for whom she served as press secretary. Welcome, Lori.
Welcome, Susan.
Whew. With that introduction alone has prompted a multitude of questions in my mind. So before we go to the sexual harassment topic, could you please tell us a bit about your work with the League of Education Voters?
Yeah, I've been the CEO of League of Education Voters, and because the world is an acronym-based world, we call ourselves LEV. But I've been the CEO of LEV now for 2.5 years. It basically was kind of, for me, the full circle nature of my career, because my passion has always been kids, and specifically helping kids who are furthest from opportunity. So one of my largest clients over the years was Treehouse, which helps foster youth. And I did fundraising and communications for Treehouse and Campfire USA, a lot of other nonprofits in Seattle. So my passion has always been kids. My other passion is advocacy, political work, community engagement. So I was working at Woodland Park Zoo a couple of years ago, and I saw this job for LEV come up. And it felt like a wonderful sort of intertwined way of looking at my love of politics, community engagement, helping kids, and applied for the job because I always had wanted to be a CEO of an organization rather than the staffer. I'm still a staffer, but now I'm the head staffer, and I love it.
Is that a power thing?
Yeah, apparently so. I never knew to this moment. Man, you're good, Susan. But I love it. I love the job. We have a team of people. We work across the state on education, advocacy around everything from kids with disabilities, early learning, kids of color, underserved communities, and it means working with legislation, working with communities in the field, and it's fulfilling. I like it a lot.
That is all the stuff you're really good at and experienced in.
Yeah, I love it.
So let's go to your experience. What motivated you to speak out about your experience with sexual harassment and former Senator Bob Packwood now? It was a long time ago.
It was. Yeah, I worked for Packwood from 90 till 92. So, yeah, a long time ago. You know, as I was mentioning to you before, there's a whole saga of being in Packwood's office as his press secretary when, you know, many people now won't even remember, most of your audience won't remember, it was a very large national news story when he was accused of sexual harassment. And 25 women accused him of sexual harassment. And at the time where it came up, I was his press secretary. So that's awkward.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's much more detailed than we have time to go into about my whole story with him. But suffice it to say, my concern that I had in working for him, we managed through it. Like, he had a bit of a crush on me. He tended to have crushes on young women, and he would express his crush, and he expressed it to me. And I said, hey, I'm not comfortable. Can you stop? acting this way, you know, because he would write me notes. And one night he tried to kiss me. And but again, he was sort of known for having these crushes. He surrounded himself with young women, and I continued working for him. And I'm actually the person who broke the news to him about the fact that the Washington Post was doing a story, because word had reached me. And I clearly recall when I told him, he said, "Good God, how do I even know? How do I know if I've harassed anyone? I don't even know what it is." And I clearly recall saying to him, "Remember that one night when you kissed me here in the office? I'm okay. I've moved on. We work well together. But if you've done that with other people over the years, we have a problem." So I guess my point being, to circle back to your question, I had managed it. When the Ethics Committee investigation came up, I actually resisted participating for a period of time because I had moved on by then. I'd left the office, and it didn't. And I actually felt a little loyalty, I guess.
Sure.
But it's a long saga of the lengths that he went to silence me, because I was the only person who was involved in the investigation from the last decade. So he was able to say, "I'm out of step with the times. Times have changed. These are ancient incidents, except for this one story." So there was about a year-long period where he tried to get me fired from my federal job. He wrote lies about me. He had his staff write lies. It was a horrible, long-term, damaging, destructive period of my life where he tried to make sure I wouldn't talk about anything. And having that happen from a person that I had actually been very close to was really devastating. And so I think what I did is I ended up cooperating with the Ethics Committee. They flew out and interviewed me. I cooperated with everything. And as the whole period finally came to a close, and for context, he was accused of harassment in 92 in the Washington Post. He did not resign until 1995. So this was a 3-year chapter of him wanting to make sure that he destroyed the women who were involved in this historic moment. So I was so conditioned through that chapter to be quiet, because you're involved in a Senate Ethics Committee investigation, and it's incumbent upon being quiet. You're not supposed to play to the crowds. You're supposed to quietly let the process unfold. So I was conditioned to never talk about it.
So there were apparently 25 other women who had accused him of sexual harassment. Yeah. Were they being quiet, and were they being interviewed by the Ethics Committee?
Yeah, and that's something that I still have to grapple with to this day, because I was the only one of the 25 that remained anonymous. And I feel guilty. I feel guilty about that. At the time, I worked for the federal government, and I worked in a very old school agency. I worked for the U.S. Bureau of Land Management. And, you know, I was the head of public affairs and communications for this region. All my peers were old white men. So I think part of it was what would happen to me at work. I also was quite a deal younger than all the rest of the people involved when this happened. For context, I was 28. So, which now feels like I was just
a baby.
Yeah. So I think there was that. I also, my husband and I had moved back from Capitol Hill to the Northwest, and he had not yet found a job. So I was the person who made the money for the family, and we had just had a baby. So for all of those reasons, it was really not an environment where I was like, oh, I'm going to take on the world and lose my job. I don't know.
Well, so a lot of that it's stuff. Kind of the essence of the impact of sexual harassment that you have described.
Yeah.
Well, before we started the show, you mentioned something about having this revelation when you were talking to your daughter's eighth grade class.
Yes.
That the sensations of your experience with sexual harassment came back to you as you were talking to them about what it's like to work on the Hill.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you first mentioned that, I thought, well, maybe that was the sensation of truly being helpless in that moment of sexual harassment. Mm. But it sounds to me like there was a whole lot more to it over at least a 3-year period.
Yeah.
Tell us more about that and what, if anything, you know about the other women who are going through this process with you.
You know, that I always felt guilty about the other women, because there were women who showed immense bravery They were out there on the front lines. They were in the Oregonian and the Washington Post. One of them called me constantly, begging me to come out and tell my story. And it's one of those things that I have to handle now. I have to accept now that when it was my turn to be brave, I was not brave, you know? And that's hard for me to say as a feminist, but I now look back and think I was not, you know, I feel like the world around me, like I mentioned to you, my dear beloved late father-in-law was a lawyer and he was sort of my counsel, you know? And it was like, I remember clearly him saying to me, it's not like you're going to get anything from talking about this. And that's the way we've been.
Absolutely. The way we've been conditioned.
Yeah.
The fact that you were the spokesperson for yet another group of good old boys.
Yeah. Yeah.
At a time when the notion of sexual harassment was relatively new, put you in a really tight spot.
And he was, and Packwood was a very powerful senator. Again, people don't remember him now, but he was the ranking member of the U.S. Senate Finance Committee. I mean, he was a very powerful senator, and I was always aware of that. I would see his staff around town in Oregon. And so anyway, all of that factored in, but still now I carry this kind of sense of, did I really do as much as I could have done then?
Well, it sounds to me like you're doing it now.
That's it. Yeah. I feel like now, I guess what I got to go back to your thing about McMurray, you know, I was talking to Emma's class and some poor kid said, what was the hardest part of working on Capitol Hill? And whoa, I just went, I think it was when I was sexually harassed. And it just came out and the whole class was listening. I feel in my memory, they were rapt. My daughter was in the back of the room horrified with her face in her hands. And she went on later in life. She's now very much a feminist, works for Planned Parenthood. And she wrote this wonderful paper about me in college, about the way she had come to see that story when it used to come up when she was growing up. I always talked about it to friends. Mm-hmm. She would always get mortified, like, oh my God, why are you bringing this up? And now she's like, please tell me more. You know, I'd like to hear more about what it was like at that time.
Well, you're kind of at the vanguard of helping her generation avoid similar fates.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the gist of the presentation you'll be making with Humanities Washington? And how is it they chose you?
So the gist is, you know, as I had kind of gone through this process of starting to be more comfortable talking about it, I mentioned to you a couple of years ago, I did an interview on KUOW about Me Too had just happened, and they wanted to have me look back from all these years later, I guess as an early Me Too-er. And after that, it's remained, I wrote a couple things for the Beachcomber. It's kind of remained in my mind of every time I talk about it, it's a weight that's taken off of me. It's a feeling of, if I talk about this and even one woman out there hears the story and says, wow, no, my boss, if I accuse my boss of something, he does not get to say this happened because she was attractive, which is what Packwood said. I mean, Packwood said ridiculous things about me.
Blame the victim.
Yeah. He said this all happened to me because I wore short skirts. I mean, that is where I find my rage around that.
Yeah, yeah.
And so for me, the thought of, I heard about Humanities Washington, it's their distinguished speaker series where you go around the state and you talk about an issue. And I thought, you know, real change is not talking on Vashon, because I'm, you know, I would not live here if this were a place that everyone shamed the women. But all over the state, we don't know how people still see this issue and bring it on. Now I'm at the place in life where I can make up for what I was not able to do earlier. And I'm happy to have dialogue. I'm happy to take the questions. So this presentation is basically a PowerPoint that I put together that shows pictures of me and Packwood. And it talks about things I look at differently now, things for me that are the big takeaways from my experience. And the big takeaway is you never get to blame the woman. After something happens, you don't get to bring up people's past. You don't get to probe at what they did. To me, that's the valuable lesson that I took.
And how do you see the rest of the world, if you will, or let's say the corporate or the government world, responding to or adopting that notion of you don't get to blame the women? What happens in court?
Yeah, This is the part that I find sort of heartbreaking, because I feel like we have shifted in terms of sexual harassment with our official positions. We do DEI trainings. You know, you come in, you check a box, you take a training. So we say we're good. But the reality is, if all of us just take a moment and think about every woman who has made an accusation and how we still see people going back and looking at that woman's life. I mean, this happened with Andrew Cuomo, right?
Yes.
Like 3 weeks ago.
Right.
So to me, I don't think the corporate world is yet woke, and they're not ready for this, and they still blame the woman. And some of it's offline, some of it's behind the scenes. But I think we all need to really, really push against that and say, you believe the woman, you don't blame the woman.
What do you surmise is the cultural foundation for this attitude that is kind of men will be men, live with it?
Yeah.
That we're struggling so hard against. What would you say is the cultural foundation for that sort of ignorance?
You know, it's, boy, that's just, that's a whole, can we have another show?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Can we take 2 or 3 hours?
I mean, one thing I would say is that we can all look at the sexism that still exists in our society, no matter how much we say it's gone, it's obviously not. Mm-hmm. And we see examples all of the time. I mean, I remember vividly recalling, I told my husband how I worked on the island for like 10 years running a little PR business from home. And I was able to do all the kids stuff, do my job. The day came where I started my job in Seattle, and it meant commuting. And I became a vice president of a big PR firm, and I was commuting every day. And I remember one day walking into the house and someone said to me, "What's for dinner?" And it was like at 7:30 at night. And luckily we've worked through these things over the years, but we talked about how there's just a built-in thing of what is the woman's job in our journey, and going into the workplace where all of a sudden it's like, no, I'm now in the workplace. I don't have to do that anymore. It's all woven together, these dated concepts of women. And what I found when I was on the Hill was this dated concept of, if you're an attractive woman and if something happens to you, it's your fault. I mean, somehow you must have sent a signal.
The idea that women are responsible for men's sexuality.
Yeah, yeah.
Or their lack of sexual control.
Yeah, exactly.
You're listening to Real Talk on the Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSHOP, Vashon Island, Washington. I'm Susan McCabe, here with Lori Hennessy, and we're talking about sexual harassment in the workplace. Lori, what do you see as the role of the Me Too movement in improving the lot of women at work now? How do you think it's working?
I think it's, I guess what I would say is that the people who seem to be sharing and leaning in and trying to push the Me Too movement are not the people that need to be sharing, leaning in, and pushing the Me Too movement. In my opinion, the people who need to do that are the people who, let me get this straight in my mind, who have a Y chromosome. It's kind of like Texas last week. I mean, not to mix issues, but I didn't hear a lot of men on Facebook. I didn't hear a lot of men out there outraged and heartbroken and angry. Why not? You know, I would push back and say that the men need to be engaged in this. And every man that I know feels differently about sexual harassment once he has a daughter.
That's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, the way we objectify women, the way women are treated when they waitress. I mean, my daughter was a waitress like every place on this island, and I used to get outraged. I would come and see the way that men acted towards her because she's a cute gal. And, you know, there are layers and layers and layers of inequity that we still have, and men have to lead the way. So to me, men should lead the way also fighting on sexual harassment. Because
guys,
they do it,
need
by
to
the
tell
way.
Guys, yeah, guys need to tell guys how to behave, because that's really who they're going to listen to.
Yeah, it's the whole culture. It's the objectifying women. It's, you know, everything from having the, you know, the posters on your locker to just the whole, it just pisses me off.
So I think there are a lot of really nice guys out there who are not sure how to behave anymore because this has become such an issue. Mm-hmm. So where would you say you can draw the line, or mm-hmm. how are good men supposed to behave in the workplace now?
My husband has a funny comment about this, because people often say, oh, times have changed. That, you know, back when I did it, it was normal, you know. He always jokes about how his dad, who was a man of great integrity, when everything was happening during Packwood, his dad said to him at one point, you know, well, call me crazy, I never did that. So there's this normalizing that I think we do by saying times have changed, when the reality is there are so many good men in the workplace who have never done those things to women.
Right. But what are those things?
Yeah.
What's crossing the line?
Yeah. I mean, for me, it all goes back all the time. I mean, I don't want to underestimate what happened to other women by Bob Packwood. I mean, there were accusations of things that were close to rape. Mm. I mean, there were horrible things he was accused of doing over many years. But by the time I worked for the man, he was like in his early 60s. So mine was not something that was scary to me. I still wasn't interested in this crush, but it was not scary. But for me, it all comes back to what he was willing to do to destroy people's reputations, to silence the story. Mm. And to me, that's the part where I find my passion, is if someone makes a mistake in the workplace, or many mistakes, like Andrew Cuomo, do you have your henchmen go out and start digging up dirt on all the women who are involved? Apparently, we still do.
Apparently, we still do. Is that what Packwood did?
Oh,
he
yeah.
started digging up dirt on
yeah.
the women who accused him.
He dug up dirt, you know, for me, tried to get me fired. He had, he called my old boss, Congressman John Miller from Seattle, who I'd worked for, and started asking all these weird questions to him. You know, was I a drinker?
Wow.
You know, he had every one of his staff write horrible letters about me. And, you know, the ethics committee ended up sharing all of the documentation later, and it was hard to see.
Oh, I can imagine.
All these letters.
Oh.
At one point in the ethics committee deposition, my favorite thing I always talk about is, at one point I was saying how Packwood had accused me of wearing short skirts. He said that, so as to why this happened. So the committee said, the senator says you wore short skirts to work. And I went, okay. And they go, will you please stand up? And I had to stand up. And they go, for the record, her skirt is appropriate.
Oh, my God.
So this was in 95, people.
Yeah, this is almost like witch hunts.
Yeah.
Literal witch yeah. hunts, not the kind that Trump talks about.
Yeah.
What sort of person do you think is most likely to abuse their position in the form of sexual harassment? Even women, because mm-hmm. there are women who are now in powerful yeah. positions.
Yeah.
Sort of person do you think does that?
Mm-hmm. I think that hopefully, as our society continues to move away from being in a society that is so based on lack of transparency and lack of authenticity, lack of power, or almost too much power. Those are things that I think if you look at the 1950s and 60s, I sort of personify it with the TV show Mad Men.
Yes.
You know, I started out in journalism, sexual harassment everywhere in radio stations, right? Theater, singing, check, check, waitressing. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. every field you can go through in your mind, there was a lot of it, right?
I had the same experience in advertising,
yeah.
in journalism,
yeah.
in public relations,
yeah.
and I learned the castrating retort.
Yeah.
How do you keep them off?
Yeah.
Find a way to whittle them down.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not fun.
No.
It doesn't make you feel like a good person.
No. And I think for me, the most I ever experienced was on the Hill. And I think it's because, to me, that is a place full of, you know, rich, white, powerful men who just didn't get questioned. I mean, no one gets questioned. I always share this story how one Sunday I was working and Packwood ran out into the office and said, the phones are down. I need help making a call. And I went into his office and I picked up the phone, and there was nothing wrong with the phone. He was trying to call someone in Arlington, and Arlington is the 703 area code. And he kept just dialing the phone again and again. He had not placed a call on his own for like a decade. And there's something wrong with that system.
Yeah. Very wrong.
Yeah.
What do you see now, if you know how things are working, mm-hmm. In DC?
Yeah.
You know what they were like back then. What, if anything, has changed? How is it different?
I mean, sadly, I think now is a horrible time, obviously, in DC. I mean, you know, I'm still heartbroken by the insurrection on the Capitol. And I mean, these are strange, strange times. And we always talk about when my husband and I were back there, we were dating and we worked for different parties. And we all played on a softball team together. There was much more of a sense of bipartisanship. So on the one hand, I despair because I feel like it was a much better time when I was there in terms of how much partisanship did or did not exist. But in terms of the weaponizing of going after women, sexual harassment, I don't think much has changed. I bet you anything. I mean, I'm not back there anymore.
Right.
But I think the behaviors that we've always hated have just become quieter behaviors. And the only inroad we have to stopping them is when it comes up, pushing back on every attempt to destroy the women and shaming the men. And you're right, women do it too. Shaming the person in power, right? And that's something where we can harness social media nowadays like we've never been able to do before.
True, true. It does make me wonder how Bill Cosby got released. And that was his strategy as well, was to shame the victims. Yeah. Somehow he was convicted and somehow he was released. Yeah. I'm not clear on that, but that's not the kind of thing that's going to support better behavior.
No, no.
Among powerful people.
I feel like we've had that behavior forever. And I just don't see it happening in DC, like in terms of the change we need, because there's so many other bigger things that we're trying to change in DC
now.
Yeah. But that's why when I came up with the presentation idea, it's the feeling of changing things slowly by many conversations. And people say that true engagement is the key to change, like truly listening to people, making connections, being across the table and talking. It takes a long time. But to me, I feel a sense of power if I can go start talking to people in small numbers, listening, learning, and giving them a face.
And Lori Hennessy, in the last minute that we have, would you tell folks how you're going to do that with Humanities Washington? Where will you be speaking? How can people engage or participate?
I would love, I'm open to speak anywhere, and they've just started the new cycle for the next 2 years, so I'll be doing this for 2 years. You go to Humanities Washington website, and they have a website, and it's all paid for. Humanities Washington pays for fees, and I can speak anywhere in the state, so we'll see how it goes in the next 2 years, but I'm one of a group of people that you can choose from.
Okay, so folks who have venues then can go to that website, the Humanities Washington website, and they can book you.
Yeah.
Very cool. Lori Hennessy, thank you so much for joining us here on Real Talk.
Thank you.
And thank you, listeners. I'm Susan McCabe, your host, here with you every Tuesday at noon, where curiosity chases truth. And I'm so grateful for your having spent a half hour with me here today. You can also hear all these shows on voiceofvashon.org.